Well, we are in Zechariah 9 tonight, and breaking some new ground. Let me read it, and if you would follow along in your Bible, Zechariah 9, verse 1. Says, the burden of the word of the Lord in the land of Hadrach and Damascus shall be its rest, when the eyes of man, as of all the tribes of Israel, shall be toward the Lord. And Hamath also shall border by it, Tyre and Sidon, though it be very wise. And Tyre did build herself a stronghold, and heaped up silver like the dust, and fine gold like the mire of the streets. Behold, the Lord will cast her out, and he will smite her power in the sea. She shall be devoured with fire. Ascalon shall see it and fear. Gaza also shall see it and be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for her expectation shall be ashamed, and the king shall perish from Gaza, and Ascalon shall not be inhabited, and a bastard shall dwell in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines, and I will take away his blood out of his mouth, and his abominations from between his teeth. But he that remaineth, even he shall be for our God, and he shall be like a governor in Judah, and Ekron like a Jebusite. And I will encamp about my house, or mine house, because of the army, because of him that passeth by, and because of him that returneth. And no oppressor shall pass through them any more, for now have I seen with mine eyes. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, upon a colt, the foal of an ass. And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth. As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant, I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit in which is no water. Turn to the stronghold, ye prisoners of hope. Even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee. When I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee like the sword of a mighty man. And the Lord shall be seen over them, and the arrow shall go forth like the lightning, and the Lord God shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with whirlwinds of the south. The Lord of hosts shall defend them, and they shall devour and subdue with sling stones. And they shall drink and make a noise as through wine, and they shall be filled like bowls and like the corners of the altar. And the Lord their God shall save them in that day as the flock of his people, for they shall be like the stones of a crown lifted up as an ensign upon his land. For how great is his goodness, how great is his beauty. Corn shall make the young men cheerful, and new wine the maids. Well, there we go. There we have it. Everybody got that? What in the world does it mean? Well, let us back away for just a minute. Let us get our bearings. Remember, the structure of this book begins with the first six chapters taking place in the second year of King Darius's reign over Persia. That would be 520 B.C. There are eight visions, depending on how you count them, that take place in one evening. And so much of the first six chapters is spent with those visions. Then, as we saw last week, there is a little bit of a break here right in the middle of the book. Chapters 7 and 8 deal with a visit of an envoy from the town of Bethel, about 10-12 miles to the north, asking questions about fasting. Remember that we learn that they had been observing a fast on the anniversary of certain important days that took place when Jerusalem was destroyed and the temple destroyed back in 586 B.C. This was when Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army came, and number one, when they first came and surrounded the city in the 12th month. That's one of the dates they were commemorating. Then in the fourth month, when they broke through the defenses of the city. Then in the fifth month, when they burned the temple and the palaces and the houses of Jerusalem. And then in the seventh month, when the people there assassinated Gedaliah, this fellow that Nebuchadnezzar had appointed to be their new governor. So they decided at that point, let's get out of Dodge. Let's get out of here. And they left for Egypt. So you have most of the people carried away captive into Babylon. The few remaining ones, including Jeremiah, by the way, who is prophesying there in Jerusalem, he is taken with the other bunch as they head to Egypt. So everybody's getting out of Jerusalem and Judah. And so the question of this delegation, as we saw last week, is, okay, we started fasting because the temple's being destroyed. Well, guess what? The temple foundations are laid. It's been 2 years now work on the temple. Should we continue fasting or should we quit? And that is what God then uses to bring them to task over a number of things. Number one, the question for to whom and for what are you fasting? And bringing up the question, are you really fasting for me or for yourselves? And we discussed at great length last week the various ways that even fasting can be perverted and turned into an exercise of trying to get out of God what you want, or trying to look better than the guy that's not fasting. All the devious ways our flesh works to take what is would be considered a good thing and to make it into a self-centered thing. And then God declared that, yes, the people are coming back, the temple is going to be rebuilt, but not because you've been fasting, because I am a jealous God. I'm jealous for my people. I'm faithful to the promises I have made, so I'm going to see to it that this is restored. So there we have those sort of in the middle of the book, this sort of diversion for a couple of chapters where we sort of deal with contemporary issues, I guess we would call them, contemporary for Zechariah anyway, things that were going on in his day about these questions. Now, the last six chapters of the book are divided between two what are called burdens. You notice in chapter 7, verse 1, we see that word here, the burden. Chapter 7, chapter 9, verse 1, the burden of the word of the Lord. That is an expression that is often used for a prophecy that comes to one of God's prophets. It's referred to as a burden in a couple of senses. Number one, it is a message that is being laid upon the prophet. The idea is that he now has the weight of this message. Secondly, you normally put a burden, if we think on a horse or a donkey, the whole point of putting the burden on there is to deliver the message. And so now that the burden has come to the prophet, his responsibility is to deliver the message to the people. So for that reason, you'll find these prophecies referred to as a burden. Now we've got two of them in these last six chapters. This is the first one tonight. I don't know whether to start right now or wait till the end to sort of give you how I look at this. Maybe it would be best to do it right now, is that what I think these burdens are showing us are the events that are about to transpire over the next few hundred years in Judah and to the people of Israel. We are at a time frame of about 520 BC, and we know that the Old Testament canon ends about 445 B.C. with the return of Nehemiah. There is then 400 years of silence between the last Old Testament prophet, Malachi, his day, and the first appearance of John the Baptist in the New Testament. So there is no scripture. There is no canonized stuff. Now, there's a lot of stuff that took place. There's a lot of history. There's a lot of events. And the Bible is not absolutely silent about those events. In fact, I believe that's what these prophecies are looking at. They're taking us from Zechariah's day up into the time of Christ. And that's how I'm going to approach this. I think it's the only thing that gives us any clue as to what's going on here. I told you about Martin Luther getting to the end of Zechariah and throwing up in his hands and said, I don't have a clue what this is talking about. Well, we'd be right there with him if we don't have some sense of what is happening. So let's look at chapter 9 tonight, and I think you'll sort of see what I'm saying. Maybe when we get through, let me ask you if I have convinced you that this is the case. I think we are looking at two future events. One that is about 150 years in the future of Zechariah. The other, another 150 years after that. So we are looking into that intra-biblical period. That is the word scholars use to refer to the time between Malachi and Matthew. Okay? So we are seeing those events prophesied by Zechariah. Well, the first one is described here in the first few verses. Notice that we have a description of something, and it will be made clear in a minute what that something is. Something that is has its beginning in the land of Hadrach in Damascus. Hadrach, is, some of these regions, it is not known precisely where they are, but we are dealing with that part of the world that we call today Syria. Syria, of course, is in the news because of all the fighting going on over there. Damascus is generally considered to be the oldest continuously inhabited city on the planet. It is generally considered to be in excess of 12,000 years old, continuously inhabited for that period of time. And so Damascus, this Damascus is right where Damascus is today. When I was in Israel, the first trip, we stopped up in the Golan Heights, right on the Syrian border. And our guide, we were looking out, we were sort of up high on the side of a mountain, looking out towards Syria. And he said, Damascus is 40 miles straight that way. And up above us on the top of the mountain were some bunkers where the Israelis have some, would say, listening posts. They can actually set up their spyglasses and see all the way to Damascus from the top of that mountain. So if Syria is trying to mass troops or get their tanks together to invade Israel, they can watch it happen right up there on top of that mountain. So that's how close Damascus is to the border of Israel right there in that spot. It's also the place, that's the road that we were looking up, the Damascus Road where Paul was converted, remember, had the encounter with Christ. It was right there. So same place, same thing. Notice the places that are mentioned here, Hadrach, Damascus, and then Hamath in verse 2. These are all associated with the land of Syria. Then he mentions Tyre and Sidon. These two cities, let me get, this is for extra credit. What was the country in biblical times that Tyre and Sidon belonged to? No? 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 Phoenicia. There you go. Phoenicia is the area where Tyre and Sidon was. Okay? Extra credit. What's the country today where Phoenicia was then? Lebanon. Just to the north of Israel. We're talking about the seacoast just to the north and west of Israel. Okay? Just up the seacoast. If you look, and maybe if you look in your maps, it'll help you sort of visualize what we're talking about here. I should have brought my, next week I'm going to bring my projector. We'll throw some maps up there that you can see better. But, if you've got a map, can you see it well enough just to get a sense of what my map roughly looks like? If you can find a map in your Bible that looks like that, do you see that little, almost like a fish hook up there towards the top of the coastline of Israel? Paige, I'll hold this up for you since, see, that's what happened. You got a phone. See that little fish hook right there? Nah, this we'll just glance at this a minute. That is where the port city of Haifa is today, where all the shipping containers and everything come into the land of Israel there at that port. Just north of there, you should see Tyre, and then north of Tyre on the coast, you'll see Sidon. Oh, this is really extra credit. Who did they worship in Phoenicia? Who is the god that they... No? No? Baal. You're exactly right. You remember the woman? There, somebody we heard, who was that, Paula? Where were we that the little girls, that was at McDonald's. We took the grandkids to McDonald's last night, did the babysitting thing. And we were back there in the playground at McDonald's, and this mother was talking to her daughter, and her name was Delilah. And I'm thinking, you know, who would name your daughter Delilah? And then I said, the only thing worse than Delilah would be Jezebel. And where was Jezebel from? Sidon. She was the daughter of the king of Sidon. So she was a Baal worshiper par excellence. And when she married King Ahab down in Israel, it was through her influence that Baal worship entered into the land. So that's a little history. So you've got the idea of Tyre and Sidon up there on the coast. Damascus now, from, I doubt it shows on your map, but it would be back to the north and east of Israel. And so what we've got is a description of something sweeping through the area of Syria and Damascus, then over to the seacoast, into the Phoenician area, Tyre and Sidon, and then going down the coast. Notice now we have a number of cities, verse 5, Ascalon, Gaza, Ekron, and there's one more, I think. Did I miss one? Ascalon, Gaza, Ekron, Ashdod in verse 6. Where are those cities to be found? There you go. Now that's Philistia, or the land of the Philistines. These were the old Philistine cities. Actually, there's five. There's another one. What would it be? Well, trust me, there's a fifth one. And those, as you can see on your map, are right straight down to the west of Jerusalem and Bethlehem, right down on the coast. That's where the Philistines settled. For instance, when David fought Goliath, Goliath was a Philistine. So David and Goliath fight right where the hills meet the flatland, in the Shephelah, the lowlands. The reason they fought, anybody remember, oh, this is really extra credit, where did David and Goliath fight? The valley of something? No? Good guess. I mean, there's only so many valleys you'd know, Valley of Jezreel being one of them. It was the Valley of Elah, E-L-A-H, the Valley of Elah. And the reason they were fighting there, if you know the topography, is there is a pass that if you can get through that valley, there was an unbroken ridge that ran all the way to Bethlehem, about 7 or 8 miles away. In other words, they would have had a straight shot into Bethlehem. And so that's why Saul and his army was blocking that valley, that pass, trying to keep the Philistines from coming up in from the lowlands up to the ridge, the high land of Israel. And so that was the significance. So the Philistines are really close. If this were downtown Jerusalem, these cities in Philistia would be roughly where Tunica is. That close. There's still Philistines down there, by the way. They're bad guys down there. Yeah, they rob you and stuff, okay? So just think, if we were in Jerusalem, that's how close the Philistine cities would be. And they are the perennial enemies of Israel. I mean, every year, the Israelites and the Philistines seemed like they went to war. And so now, whatever this is, notice your map again, started up in the northeast, went over to the coast, to the northwest of Israel. Now, it is sweeping down the coast, due west of Israel. And so the question is, what is this thing? Well, look at verse 8. God says, I will encamp about my house. Now remember, this thing, whatever it is going down the coast. Jerusalem is inland, probably no more than about 20 miles. But God is saying, I will encamp about my house. He's talking about the temple. Because of the army, because of him that passeth by, and because of him that returns. So now we know what we're having mapped out for us. It is the advance of an invading army that is invading first Damascus and Syria, then the Phoenician cities of Tyre and Sidon, then the Philistine cities, four of them mentioned here. And that there is somebody at the head of this army, a him, who is passing by one way and then will return going the other way. In other words, whoever this is making two passes nearby Jerusalem, and God is saying, I will protect my house. Now, he's talking about the temple which is, by the way, under construction when these things are being said and prophesied. So God is going to protect his people, his temple, while this army passes by heading south, and then later on returning, going north. Now, The thing that fits this description to a T is the military career of Alexander the Great. And remember that from Daniel, who was earlier than Zechariah, we had the information that there's going to be these four world empires. Babylon, which is going to fall to the Persians, and that's just happened. Remember, that's why they're back in Israel. Then Persia is going to fall to the Greeks, and the Greeks are going to fall to the Romans. Each one of these empires, in turn, will rise up and be the world empire on the scene, and then they will fall to the next one who will subdue them. And that sequence of four kingdoms is what we're seeing happen in Zechariah's day, and now we're looking ahead to the next kingdom. Let me give you a little bit of history about how all this happened. Remember, the Babylonians fell to the Persians. King Cyrus is in fact referred to as a type of Messiah in that he has conquered the enemy of Israel and now has set them free to go back home. Zechariah is back in Israel because of that. But he is king of Persia. By the way, where is Persia today? Iran is modern day, is the modern country that sits where Persia is. The Persian Peninsula, you'll hear that mentioned. The Persian Gulf. Where the oil traffic flows through. What was Iraq? That was Babylon. So Babylon would be to the north and east of Persia, but Babylon has now fallen to the Persians. The Persian Empire is now expanding, and it especially is expanding west. It defeated Lydia. I think I told you about the king of Lydia going to the Oracle of Delphi, asking if he should attack the Persians, and the oracle told him that if he did, a great empire would fall, and he assumed that it was talking about the Persian Empire. In fact, apparently it was talking about his. Of course, that's pretty safe. If you attack the Persians, a great empire will fall. One or the other is going to fall. That's part of the Oracle of Delphi. Some of these prophecies were very, very ambiguous. But nevertheless, the king of Lydia, which is in Asia Minor, where Turkey is today, attacks the Persians and winds up getting destroyed. Well, the Persians kept coming west. And the thing that is west of Turkey is Greece. And so in 480 B.C., which is some 40 years after Zechariah, King Xerxes of Persia will take his army and his fleet and attack Greece, attempting to conquer. Now, they had a number of wars, minor wars, but this was a major, major invasion. It is that invasion that we have the story of the 300 Spartans under Leonidas that stopped the Persian advance at Thermopylae for several days, allowing the Greek army to escape and regroup. You know the story a little bit about that. Originally, he had about 7,000 men plugging the hole. I've been down the coast of Greece there. Today, the sea has retreated away, but in that day, the distance between the pass around the mountain there at the sea would have been about where that wall is, and the mountain about where that wall is. So you have this little narrow space that the Persian army, numbering somewhere between 150 and 200,000 men, are going to pass through. And Leonidas, with about 7,000 men, held the gap, stopped them for several days. Eventually, they were betrayed. A local gave them a path, a route that would circle around behind the Spartans. And they dismissed most of their men, but Leonidas kept the 300 Spartans as well as a few hundred other auxiliaries, and they managed to hold the Persian advance until they were all slaughtered. Sort of like the Alamo. They all perish, but the Alamo gave Sam Houston time to gather an army together and train them to fight Santa Anna. That's what happened here. They were able to hold off the Persian advance long enough for the Greek army to escape. They're trying to conquer more land. They're just, in other words, that's the next nation in their path that they're in the process of trying to expand. So Greece is next. They've defeated Lydia. They're in Asia Minor. And now Greece is the next thing in their way. Now, what happened is the Greeks then evacuated Athens out to the island of Salamis. If you drive from Athens down to Corinth, the island of Salamis, if you're driving south, and the island is all along the coast there. It's a long, skinny island, and there's a bay between the mainland and that island. And the Persians had these great, big warships. And the Greeks lured them into that bay. And usually these big warships were invincible, except in that bay where the waters were shallow, these big ships couldn't maneuver. And the Greek ships were much smaller and much faster. And Xerxes, and Nico was showing me the mountain where Xerxes had his throne brought and set up for him on the mainland. You can look right across and see the bay and the island to watch his Persian fleet defeat the Greeks. And lo and behold, he got to watch his own fleet wiped out by the Greeks because they sank or burned almost all the Persian navy. So it was a tremendous defeat for the Persians. That takes place about 480 B.C. In other words, what's important about that is the Persian advance to the west is now stopped in its tracks by the Greeks. Then, a little later, we're going to see the Greeks get their revenge when this guy named Alexander comes along the scene. He is born, let me get my dates right here, in 356 B.C. He will die in 323 B.C. just before he's 33 years old. He begins his career. He's born to the king Philip II of Macedonia, the northern part of Greece. And under Philip, he manages to more or less unite Greece together and train a professional army. And Philip is assassinated when Alexander is 20 years old. And Alexander assumes command of the army and crosses the Hellespont, it's called, a place where Europe and Asia sort of come close together, and takes this Grecian army, numbering probably in the 30,000 range, across into Persia. He is met at the Granicus River by several Persian generals. They think it will be an easy matter of cleaning, you know, wiping his plow. They outnumber him about 3-1. And lo and behold, Alexander defeats these Persian generals. Well, King Darius, this is not the Darius we're familiar with. This is Darius III. There's a bunch of Dariuses in Persia. Now, Darius, king of Persia, assumes that the problem was he wasn't there. It was his generals doing this. He wasn't there to command the army. And so they meet again at a place called Issus, further to the east. And there is a huge battle. Alexander's men, again, are outnumbered about 3-1. But miraculously, they defeat the Persian army. The Persian king, Darius, is forced to flee for his life. His men flee. And all of a sudden, there's nothing in between Alexander and the Persian capital. But Alexander, they don't call him the great for nothing. He does the smart thing. Rather than pursuing the Persians on deep into Persia, he turns south around the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea to protect his southern flank. That's what's being described here. If you look again at a map, and I promise you I will have you a map next time where you can see better. Do you have a map similar to this one that shows you the Mediterranean? In other words, what's happened? Here's Greece. They've crossed into Asia Minor. There's a big battle right here, the Granicus River. Then Issus is back over in here. And so the Persians flee back in that direction. But instead of chasing them, Alexander swings to the south into Syria, Phoenicia. And the reason he's passing by is he's heading to Egypt. And so what he's going to do, he's going to conquer Egypt in just a little over a year. He manages to conquer Egypt. I mean, this guy was good. And he establishes a city named after himself, Alexandria, that's destined to become one of the greatest cities in the world, has the world's best library there, a place of Greek learning right in the middle of Egypt. And then he swings back up the coast. In other words, he passes by Jerusalem twice, coming and going. Well, there's a great mystery. Why didn't he attack Jerusalem? I mean, he attacks everything else. Well, we have the divine side of the picture given to us in our text. God says he's going to protect his house, the temple in Jerusalem, from this army and this guy that passes by in both directions. Humanly speaking, we are not certain, but there is a Jewish legend. You can read this if you can find a copy of Josephus. It's online, and it's a fascinating read. The story the Jews tell of why Alexander... Let me give you the history. After he attacks Damascus, he goes over to Tyre and Sidon. Sidon falls very quickly, but Tyre is another story. Tyre was a city that earlier had a part on the mainland and then part on an island that's a half mile offshore. Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians tried to destroy Tyre. They'd managed to destroy the mainland town, but the rest of the people fled to this island a half mile offshore, and he besieged it for something like 12 years and never was able to take it. So he finally gave up, went back to Babylon. So the mainland city was destroyed, but this island city, and I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the walls of that island city. They've uncovered some of that, that these walls, instead of being set back from the sea where you've got a beachhead, they came right down to the sea. So there was really no way to invade. You had no land for your soldiers if you're going to take them out there by ship. There's no place for them to get off. The walls of the city came right down into the water. Well, what Alexander did when his army comes, he, first of all, they told him he was welcome there and so forth, and he told them that he wanted to come into their city, this island city, to sacrifice to Hercules. It was sort of his patron saint, I guess we'd call it. Well, they decided, they got cold feet, says, no, we're not going to let you come in here. Well, that's when his army then began to lay siege to the city. Tyre was a very, very rich city because of its trade. Did you notice the reference here in verse 3 to silver and gold, sort of like dirt and dust that accumulated there? They control the sea traffic around the Mediterranean Sea. In those days, you typically didn't take a ship straight across the Mediterranean. It's far too dangerous. You hugged the seacoast. And so it controlled the water traffic there along the shore of the Mediterranean Sea. And because of that, I'm trying to think of cities today that are rich because of trade. Hong Kong, perhaps, would be one. Singapore. Houston, yeah. Bahia, I don't know, you know, whatever. But in other words, because of its location, this was a very, very rich city. And it felt that it was absolutely impregnable because of the fact of its position, being a half mile out into the sea, surrounded by these walls. Just didn't think anybody could ever attack them and succeed. Alexander, what he did was have his men take the ruins of the old city there on the mainland and build a causeway about 200 feet wide, a half a mile long, out to that island. Now, they attacked it several times, burned towers, burned part of it at one point, and he'd just keep rebuilding. They finally got the causeway close enough they could bring their siege engines out there, catapults and so forth, to launch their, you know, fire stuff in to the city. And finally, when they were able to complete that causeway, his army invaded. And by that time, Alexander was not in a good mood. He defeated that city in about 7 months. Nebuchadnezzar gave up after 12 years. Alexander did it in 12 months. He sold about 26,000 of them into slavery. And then the men that were left, figures ranged from a couple of thousand up to about 7,000, he crucified on the banks of the Mediterranean Sea there because of their resistance to his rule. So he made a pretty big statement there. And so that's the destruction of Tyre. Then he marched further south down into the Philistine areas. And the main city that gave him trouble there was Gaza. Gaza, of course, in the news, the Gaza Strip there along the coast of Israel today. His men were able to, you know what sappers are? Sappers in military parlance. A what?
A private?
No, it's the people that tunnel under stuff. Today, sappers, at least in World War II, were the ones that would tunnel under stuff and lay charges and blow up walls and stuff. Of course, in the old times, they didn't have the explosive charges. But the idea was, if we can't go over your wall, if we can undermine it and cause your wall to collapse, then we can defeat you. And that's what happened at Gaza. His men undermined the wall there. It fell in. They were able to take the city. Now, the legend that the Jews tell, and I say legend because half of me wants to believe it, half of me doesn't. We just don't know for certain. But the story, it's a question of why didn't Alexander attack Jerusalem? And the story that comes out of Josephus, and there are several places this same story is told, is that while Alexander was besieging Gaza, they're close by, he sent word to Jerusalem that they were next. And so they were expecting that they would be the next stopping point for Alexander's army. And so the high priest prayed and fasted to decide what needed to be done. And what happened was when Alexander marched to Jerusalem, came over Mount Scopus, is where suddenly you can see the city down below. And here stands the high priest in his robes with the mitre on his forehead. That's the only place you had the name of God, the four letters that spell Yahweh on his mitre. And all the other priests in white robes lined up behind him. The gates of the city open wide and all the people out welcoming him into Jerusalem. So rather than resisting him, the high priest said in a dream, God told him to do this. He opens the gates to Jerusalem. They took Alexander inside the city. He supposedly offered sacrifice at the temple. His generals were furious because they wanted him to destroy them. The reason he had sent a message to Jerusalem, he had sent saying, send me supplies, send me help, or if you don't, you're next. Well, they didn't send it. So his generals wanted revenge on Jerusalem. And they asked Alexander, why didn't you destroy them? Why are you treating them this way? And Alexander replied that before he ever left Greece, he had had a dream and seen this fellow, the high priest, in that dream, who gave him permission to attack Persia. In other words, he had seen a man standing in a robe like that with the mitre on his head and the name of God before he ever left Greece. And so he recognized that this is the same person he saw in the dream. Well, it's not permission, but in other words, a commission might be a better word, that God is directing him to attack Persia. The story also, Josephus says, it says they took him into the temple and showed him prophecies from Daniel and Zechariah that spoke of the rise of Greece. Now, is that true? I don't have a clue. What is fascinating to me, though, is what we find here in verse 9. After this description in verse 8 that God is going to put his hand over his house there in Jerusalem and nobody is, you know, going to touch it. Then verse 9, rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king comes unto thee. He is just, having salvation, lowly, riding upon an ass, upon a colt, the foal of an ass. Now, there is no question that this is a messianic prophecy. In all four gospels, this is quoted and applied to Jesus. This is the time we call the triumphant entry, when he rode on the donkey, you remember, into Jerusalem. People came out waving their palm branches and welcoming him into the city. What is significant is that if Alexander did approach Jerusalem, the contrast, in other words, the similarity is that you have king number one, Alexander, coming to Jerusalem, who is welcomed by the crowds. Okay, now you got king number two, Jesus, who comes to Jerusalem, welcomed by the crowds. The difference is how they would come. The thing Alexander is noted for is his war horse, Bucephalus. He's one of the most famous horses in all of the ancient world. Bucephalus is a name that means ox head. So if you nickname somebody ox head or Bucephalus, that's what you're calling them. It is said that this horse is a huge black horse, had a brand of an ox head on one of his legs. So the name came from that. When Alexander was 12 years old, 11 or 12, a man brought this horse to Alexander's father, Philip, king, to sell him. And he wanted to get a really good price because this was quite a specimen of a horse, all reports say. And the problem was is that none of his men could ride the thing. He was so wild. And Alexander began to mock, and Philip just basically said, "I don't want the horse," you know. Well, Alexander, a boy, 11 or 12 years old, began to mock these men who were trying to ride Bucephalus and saying, "Are you going to let a good horse get away?" You know, and so forth. Well, he kept this up till finally his father turns to him and says, "You know, what do you know about it? These are grown men. You think you know better?" And Alexander said, "You let me try. I'll pay for him if I can't. And if I can ride him, I get him for myself." And so Philip said, "Okay, go ahead." Well, what Alexander had noticed is that this horse was afraid of his own shadow. And so he turned the horse into the sun and jumps up on him and takes off riding. And it said that when he returned to his father, Philip, his father was weeping and said, "My son, Macedonia is too small for you." A hint of what was coming. This is 11 or 12 year old boy that's doing this kind of thing. So Bucephalus became the war horse that Alexander rode into battle. He would then use that horse as they would go clear to India. The horse, as well as Alexander, was wounded on several occasions. Eventually, the horse died just shortly before Alexander himself died. But during his entire career of conquering the world, this is the big war horse he rode. And that's what you expect of a conquering general, to ride such a horse. The contrast that's being made here is that Zion, your king, is going to come to you, but he's coming in a very different way than a conqueror on a war horse. He's coming riding on a donkey, and not even a big donkey, the foal of an ass, a colt, a little donkey. Now, I've had a little bit of experience riding those mules down there in Mexico, and let me tell you, some of those things are so small that you can't sit in the middle of their back. You got to sit back over their hind end because they don't have enough strength to hold you up in the back. And you look a little ridiculous because, you know, even as short as I am down there, I'm a tall guy up in the Indian areas. And it's like your feet are almost dragging the ground. This is not exactly what you expect to see of a conquering general riding into town on a little bitty donkey. You understand? So you see the contrast here? And that's what tends to make me think that something similar to what the Jewish legend relates could have occurred, because that's the contrast that is being made here in this prophecy. That unlike Alexander conquering with an army, conquering riding on a big war horse, here comes your king, Judah, riding unto you. He's meek, he's lowly. He's just. He has salvation. Then notice in verse 10, he goes on to say, "I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim, the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, from the river even to the ends of the earth." In other words, this king, the one who comes lowly, meek, humble, that's humility is what's being described here. His kingdom is going to stretch from sea to sea, all over the earth. It is rather remarkable, isn't it? I don't know anybody today that worships Alexander the Great. I know a lot of people that worship the king that came riding into town on a donkey. I read a fellow who was talking about the difference between Nero and Paul. He said, you know, Nero martyred Paul and Peter. But he said, today, people name their sons Paul and Peter. They name their dogs Nero. In other words, these guys have their day. As we say, every dog has his day. Well, they had their day. Alexander had his day. But that day is long gone. This king, the one who comes to Jerusalem, is going to come in a very, very different fashion. But his kingdom will be the one that endures. It will be peace. It will not only be that, but look at verse 11. As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant have I sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit in which is no water. In other words, this phrase, the blood of the covenant. You remember when we partake of the Lord's table, that passage out of 1 Corinthians 11. This cup is the New Testament, the new covenant in my blood. Here is the blood that is shed to free prisoners, to redeem. That's the argument Paul uses in Romans, that his blood is the redemption price, that we're bought with a price. We've been freed from the pit. That's the language of redemption going on here. So we see this universal kingdom, this redemption, freeing of the prisoners, all brought about by this king that rides into Jerusalem on this little donkey. Any questions at this point? Any? It's saying that the Philistine cities are going to be assimilated into Israel. Remember, the Jebusites were the original Canaanite tribe that were there where Jerusalem eventually would sit. They were part of the old Canaan that Israel never did conquer till David's day. And David finally, with the Joab, managed to get off the waterspout and take this fort called Zion. That's where the name Zion comes from, by the way, this old Jebusite fort that existed there. And so they more or less were assimilated into Israel. So it's basically saying that the Philistines, their blood, their abominations, remember they worshipped what's his name? You said it a moment ago. Dagon. They worshipped Dagon. These things, in other words, the Philistine culture is going to be destroyed. And what's left will be assimilated into Israel. That's what's being described here. So, and that, they get, thanks to Alexander the Great, that's destroyed. Okay, so that's the first half of this thing. Now, starting in verse 12, we see that there's more to the story, though, that not only will God protect Israel from Greece, this Grecian army that passes by under Alexander. Starting in verse 13, we see that the sons of Zion are going to fight against the sons of Greece. You see that there in verse 13? So in other words, and now what I'm saying, if we fast forward another 150 years or so from the time of Alexander the Great, we're going to learn that what this is referring to, at least, let me put it this way. This is my best guess. This is my sanctified logic, sanctified reasoning going on here, but I know of no better explanation because indeed what is being described here did happen. Now it's being described in very apocalyptic language. The genre of prophecy uses, we think, well, we got away from those strange visions back there in the first part of Zechariah. Now we're going to get over to the easy stuff. No, it's still very difficult to understand all this language because it's employing what we would call apocalyptic language, prophetic language. But clearly what's going on here is now the forces of Israel are fighting against the forces of Greece, and that indeed happened starting in about 167 AD, about 150 years now further into the future from Alexander the Great. Let me just sort of describe the rest of the story of Alexander. Once he got through conquering Egypt, came back into Persia, by this time Darius has gathered his army together for one last shot at the Grecian army. It's a battle that takes place at a place called Gaugamela. Again, it was a huge, huge battle, but Alexander once again came victorious. Darius flees for his life back into Persia. He is assassinated by some of his own troops, and suddenly Alexander is king of Persia. He marries a Persian wife named Roxanne. He begins to dress in Persian garb, much to the dismay of his Greek soldiers, his fellow soldiers. But he, for a while, sort of goes Persian on them. And then begins to head further east into India. And that will be the furthest extent of his conquering, mainly because he just didn't know there's anything else left out there to conquer. His army, by this time, they had been fighting for over 10 years since they had started the battles. They were ready to go home, and so Alexander turned back. He eventually died, as I said, just before his 33rd birthday. And upon his death, his kingdom, his empire, was divided between his generals. And the generals that are of importance to us is a fellow named Seleucus, who took Syria to the north of Israel, and Ptolemy, who took Egypt to the south. So now we have, and keep in mind, these guys are Greeks. They become the ruling dynasties, the kings, if you will, of Syria to the north, Egypt to the south. The Ptolemies, we normally think of these dynasties as being Egyptian. But in this case, the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt was Greek. Cleopatra was the last, her son was the last of this line, and when he died, that line died out, and she, of course, committed suicide. And so Cleopatra was not an Egyptian, per se. She was a Greek of that Ptolemy family. So we've got two families, the Seleucids, and these generals, generally, they didn't get along. And so over the next 150 years, there's war that breaks out between the Syrians up here, the Seleucids, they're called, in Syria, and the Ptolemies down here in Egypt. So they're fighting like cats and dogs, and guess who's right in the middle? Israel. So for a while, Israel would be under the control of the Seleucids to the north, and other times Israel would be under the dominion of the Ptolemies to the south. So it's back and forth, back and forth. They were sort of the no man's land trapped in the middle. Well, eventually, in about 170 B.C., there is a Seleucid king by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes who comes on the scene. He again launches a military operation against Egypt. He goes down there. He's defeated. And on his way back to Syria, he takes out his frustration on the Jews. He basically tries to forcibly Hellenize them. And by Hellenization, what you mean is that you're forcing them to embrace Greek culture. Basically, it's get with the program. Because countries that were not yet Hellenized were seen as backwards, you know, ancient. It would be much, say, as we would view maybe the Amish. You know, they're just living in the past. They're not modern. And so Antiochus attempts to forcibly Hellenize Judah and Jerusalem. For instance, he forbids the Jewish families to circumcise their children upon penalty of death. He forces them, he sets up an altar to, I believe it's Zeus, my memory is correct, in the temple, and begins to force them to offer incense to this idol. He forbids the observance of the Sabbath. So he's doing everything in his power to end what we would call Jewish customs and to forcibly convert them to a Greek way of doing things. Well, there is, by the way, he desecrates the temple. He offers a sow on the altar, makes broth out of the sow's meat, and splashes it on all the temple. So this guy was not a good guy, okay? You can sort of sense what's coming. There was a priest living out in the country by the name of Mattathias, and he's coming into Jerusalem along with another guy, and they are met by some of these Greeks who have an idol and demand that they burn incense to this idol. Well, the other guy does it to save his life, basically. Mattathias takes a sword and kills both his friend that offered incense to this idol and kills the Greek guy that's telling them they've got to do it. And that touches off a revolution. Mattathias has five sons, and they are known as the Maccabeans. The Maccabean name is a nickname. It means the hammer. Mattathias will die within a year, leading this rebellion. It's like a guerrilla warfare that breaks out. One by one, his sons then become the leader of the army. The most famous of his sons is Judas. Judas Maccabeus is the Judas the Hammer, is what that would mean. Now, the family name is not Maccabees. That's, again, a nickname. It's Hasmonean, the Hasmonean family line. Very important. I mean, it's not important to our study, but if you want to understand the situation just prior to Jesus in Jerusalem, the Hasmoneans is this priestly line that took control of the country. Now, keep in mind, the Romans are ruling, but it is the Hasmonean priestly line that is the dominant family. It's, you know, it's a political family that's controlling things in Israel. Herod the Great, you know, he was an Edomite. He was trying to legitimize his rule over Israel. He marries his wife Mariamne, who is the daughter of the Hasmonean priest. So he is trying to marry into this politically connected family to give his own rule a little more legitimacy. He winds up killing Mariamne and then winds up mourning her, building his palace at three towers, one of which was named Mariamne. He, of course, he kills his sons, he kills his wife, kills his mother-in-law. His mother-in-law can understand. Anyway, that's another story. But anyway, this Hasmonean line, if you ever run into that line, you'll know what she's talking about. He's talking about the Maccabeans. This is their family name. That once they succeeded in driving out the Syrians, they become sort of the ruling group there in Israel. Eventually, after about 3.5 years, they succeed in driving the Syrians out of Israel. A great victory. They win their independence for a few years before the Romans come and dominate them. 63 was when Pompey came to Jerusalem, but I think they were already under the dominion. But it's roughly about that same time frame. Pompey was a Roman general that came and subdued them. So they, for about 100 years, they were actually independent, sort of. About 100 years. Yes. So Rome now has, at the end of, has become the dominant party. So you get the picture that amazingly, this bunch of priests, this priestly family, are able to drive the Syrians out of Jerusalem. They then embark on a several-month process of cleansing the temple that ended in about the time frame our December, and that is observed today by the feast of Hanukkah. In other words, that's why the Jews are celebrating Hanukkah roughly at the same time we're celebrating Christmas. They are commemorating the event of the cleansing, the rededication of the temple in the days of the Maccabeans. So, there, and if you think about it, what's being described here in verse 13 is a conflict between the sons of Zion. Notice that God, here's this prophetic language. Judah is being bent like a bow, and Ephraim is being laid in the bow like an arrow, that God is going to shoot the arrow of Judah and Ephraim at the sons of Greece. And so in the next few verses, verse 14 and 15, the Lord is going to come alongside them, make them victorious. Verse 16, the Lord their God shall save them in that day as the flock of his people. In verse 17, how great is his goodness and so forth, the praise that he receives for this. So all of this, if you ask me, what is my best guess? And again, let me say, when we're dealing with prophetic books, especially Zechariah, it doesn't pay to be too dogmatic. We can be wrong. We're dealing in probability, sort of like the weather forecast. We're doing the best we can with what we've got here. The thing that makes the most sense is indeed, as we look ahead from the days of Zechariah, what's the next big things on the horizon? Well, there's the rise of Alexander the Great. Then there's the war with the Syrians, Antiochus Epiphanes, and so forth. It appears that much of the language of the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, when Jesus says, when you see the abomination of desolation, the abomination that makes desolate appear, and he says, written in Daniel. In other words, it appears that he's making reference to something that's coming. Notice whatever Jesus is referring to is still future, but he's saying it's like what Antiochus Epiphanes did. This abomination that makes desolate. That's what happened in Epiphanes' day. He offered this sow on the altar, desecrated the temple to where they couldn't use it until they had gone through this re-cleansing process. That there's something like that coming again that Jesus is referring to in Matthew 24. Okay, those are the two big things on the horizon. And that's how I then would see the prophecy that this is what's coming. Here's the future. We'll approach again this the same way. Next time, I think we've got to take two chapters together, and that's going to be difficult. Notice in chapter 12, we've got 10 and 11 next time. Chapter 12 begins again in verse 1, the burden of the word of the Lord for Israel. In other words, we have the second burden beginning in chapter 12 and now going to the end of the book. So there's where we are. Let me stop here and let's discuss this a little bit.
Can we look at that?
Yeah. Matthew 24. Matthew 24, verse 15. Jesus says, "When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet." Now, you say, well, wait a minute, why did he say Zechariah? Well, Daniel spoke of an abomination that would last for basically 3.5 years. And that is roughly the time frame of the Maccabean revolt from about 167 B.C. to into at the end of 164 B.C. if my mind is... That's right. The temple was desecrated during that time frame before they then took several months after they drove the Syrians out to rededicate it. Yeah, well, they controlled. Of course, he was in and out, and his armies were controlling the area. Keep in mind, the Maccabean War was like a guerrilla warfare, hit-and-run type thing. It was only at the final battle there at Jerusalem where they actually sort of came together like two armies, but they were able to win the day and drive the Syrians out.
Is there something in this text
that's
like Christ is saying that...
Well, turn over to Luke 21, where you got the parallel... in fact, I guess we could go to Mark. Mark 13 is very similar to what we read there in Matthew. But in Luke 21, where we have this version of the Olivet Discourse, when you shall see, and this is Luke 21, verse 20, rather than when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, now, in Luke 21, verse 20, when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that its desolation is near. Notice this theme of desolation is pretty prominent here. And so it's the idea that what it seems to be the best way to understand it, Charles, is that what happened in Antiochus Epiphanes' day, something like that is going to happen again. The temple is going to be desecrated to the sense that it is unusable. And so when he speaks in Matthew and Mark, he uses this language, when you see the abomination of desolation. In other words, it's back to this double fulfillment of prophecy that we see a version of it fulfilled in the days of Antiochus Epiphanes. But clearly, in Matthew 24, Jesus is talking about something future to him, when you shall see it. Then Luke 21 makes it a little clearer that it is this desolation that will occur when Jerusalem is surrounded by armies. And my best understanding, keep in mind that that's exactly what happened in 70 AD when the Romans came and destroyed the city and the temple. They surrounded Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. The Christians evacuated, and again, our sources are very, very spotty. We're leaning a lot on Eusebius, who was writing in the 4th century. He was Constantine's historian, but he had access to sources we don't have today. He says that the Christians escaped Jerusalem, went across the Jordan River, the Transjordan they call it, to the area of Decapolis, where they stayed at a place called Pella for the duration of the war when the Romans came. So that what Jesus is saying here, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, that's your signal to get out, to flee. In which, as best we know, that's exactly what the Christians in Jerusalem did. There were two, in 66 A.D., the Roman governor, Cestius, up in Syria, by the way, marched against Jerusalem with the 12th Legion. Now keep in mind, there by this time there was just constant agitation going on in Jerusalem. The Jews were doing everything in their power to make war with the Romans. Finally, the Romans had enough. They sent Cestius Gallus with the 12th Legion down to put an end to it. He laid siege to Jerusalem, surrounded the city. That's 66 A.D. For some strange reason that his generals didn't understand, he called off the siege right at the point where he was about to undermine the wall. And they withdrew. And as they are withdrawing down the pass at Beth Horam, remember I talked about the pass up from the Valley of Elah to Bethlehem, where there's another one up just north, a little bit north of there. The pass at Beth Horam runs right up to north of Jerusalem, up around close to where Bethel would be. And what he's doing is taking his army down that pass where he is ambushed by Jewish forces from two directions, and the pass is so narrow that his soldiers can't get into their formation. You know, you're familiar with that turtle. They lock their shields together to where they are completely surrounded by their armor. But the pass was so narrow they couldn't get into their formations, and they were absolutely annihilated. I say annihilated. Cestius Gallus escaped. They stole his eagle, which for a Roman general was the worst thing that could happen. He dies shortly thereafter. Most speculate that he killed himself for the shame of losing the legion's eagle. About half his army was wiped out in that battle. So this, and in other words, trying to put the scene together as best we can, that then becomes the signal to all these Jews that, hey, we can do this. We can defeat them. And so all the Jews from the countryside took off into Jerusalem. It appears that is it at that time that the Christians see their chance. In other words, the question is, once Jerusalem is surrounded by armies, how do you get out? How do you flee? But what happened, they're surrounded by armies twice. The first time by Cestius Gallus and his forces, and when they withdraw, what appears to have happened is the Christians leave Jerusalem while all the Jews are flooding into Jerusalem thinking they're going to be able to defeat the Romans. But what happens, of course, is that now Nero sends four legions, led by his best general, Vespasian. And Vespasian, while he's coming through northern Israel, Galilee, back in Rome, Nero commits suicide. There's a civil war going back there for control. Vespasian leaves the army in the control of his son Titus, and he goes back to Rome and will become the next Caesar. Titus, in the meanwhile, will take these four legions and lay siege to Jerusalem in 70 A.D. and will utterly destroy the city, burn the temple. And as we say, the rest is history. So the Romans will finally come and destroy what's there. But that's that's my best guess. Our sources are very spotty. But that's what Jesus is telling his people to do. When you see this happen, get out of Dodge. And they had the opportunity to do it, because Jerusalem actually was surrounded not once but twice. By the way, the 10th Legion, which was the legion left in charge of Jerusalem after it was destroyed, they were the ones that laid siege to Masada. Later on, Masada held out for another 2 years. Their emblem, I never knew this before, their symbol of their standard was a pig. A pig.
We must have been from Arkansas.
They were from Arkansas. Razorback. Yeah. Charles? I don't know. The bottom line, I don't know. I would say there's a break in the prophecy in verse 12, that verse 12 begins another leap forward about 150 years. In other words, we've left what's going on in the time of Alexander the Great. Now we're fast forwarding from verse 12 on 150 years to what's happening in the Maccabean period. It is interesting to me in some respects, though, what you're asking. Do I know? No. Paul having the Macedonian dream. You ever thought about that? That when Paul has drifted with his party on his second missionary journey all the way across Asia Minor, what is Turkey today, he winds up roughly at Troas on the tip, and there's no more land. He's at the sea. He's at the Aegean Sea. That night, he has the dream of this Macedonian saying, come over here and help us. And so they set sail for Greece, for Macedonia. And so now the gospel is invading Alexander's home turf. And the fascinating thing to me, I'm wanting to start a study on 1 Thessalonians. And in studying that, the church in Philippi, which was the first church established in Macedonia, and then Thessalonia, those two churches are like his favorite churches. They are the ones who support him on his missionary journey. They've got his back. And it's just amazing the affection that Paul manifests for these two churches, and they for him. And it has crossed my mind that this is interesting, that this is Alexander the Great's home turf that is now being invaded by the gospel. And so, again, who's the great general here? Is it the one on Bucephalus, or is it this king who's come riding into town on the little donkey? Which one prevails in the long run? And it's not Alexander, it's Jesus that eventually wins the day. Macedonia is part of Greece. Now, this is what complicates the thing. When Yugoslavia fell apart after the fall of the Soviet Union, the southern part of Yugoslavia renamed itself Macedonia. But it is not historic Macedonia. The Greeks, I learned, view them with disdain because they have usurped the name that has always been associated with northern Greece, and they're actually right to the north of Greece. But you see Macedonia on the map. They will not even name, they will refuse to say the word Macedonia when they're talking about that country. They call it by the name of its capital, Sofia, or something like that. They will not even give it the benefit of being called Macedonia because they have robbed them. Macedonia is the northern part of what we would call Greece. And that's historically where Alexander came from and all these things took place.
Alexandria became Constantinople.
No. Istanbul and...
But before that it was Alexandria,
right? No, Alexandria is in Egypt.
Oh, that's right.
That's way up there in, where Turkey and Greece comes together.
So
Yeah, Byzantia. Yeah. When the Muslims took over, they renamed it. Okay.
And Orient Express ran from Istanbul to where?
Paris, I think, which originally. Always thought it'd be neat to ride the...
That's
right. Yeah, from Russia with Love. Yeah, you got it. That's where we learn most of our history from James Bond movies. All right, any other thing? Have I thrown too much history at you? I realize, in other words, you begin to realize the dark, this time frame of those 400 years, we say the 400 years of silence, aren't that silent if this prophecy is referring to the events of those times. That they are covered, but they're being covered in a prophetic way. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that our King is this one who is lowly and meek and humble, the one who comes to his people riding on a foal. We thank you for his willingness to lay down his life, to conquer not by physical force or brute strength, but fought by the power of the Spirit, the power of changing lives. Thank you for a Savior like that. Thrill us once again with the thought of all this, of how these things fell into place exactly as you foreordained. And may that ensure our confidence that, yes, this is the Messiah, this one who came to his people long ago. Thank you for each one here. Lord, sharpen our minds, our thinking as we think about these things. Help us as we work our way through them. We know it's easy to go astray, but may we profit from it. May it edify our souls. May it equip us better for your service. In Jesus I pray. Amen.